Today we're going to enter a panel talk about the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path, and that's right view, which in Pali is samadhi. And I just want to go over some of what we learned this month, of what I've learned. That right view is not about adopting a belief. It's about learning to see clearly, to see our lives, our sufferings, and our joys. And it's about seeing the systems around us. As they truly are. And right view is, it guides us to ethical living and to liberation. As the Buddha said, just as the dawn is the forerunner of the rising sun, so it is right view, the forerunner of wholesome states. Right view prepares us everything else, our actions, our speech, our effort, and for us, especially as modern lay practitioners navigating in this world that's so entangled in suffering, violence, and injustice. And right view is a tool of decolonial wisdom. Empowering us, the conditioned, that have something to mute themselves. And Mike, can you mute yourself? So right view is a tool of decolonial wisdom, empowering we the conditioned and the oppressed through right understanding, not blind belief or. So right view invites us to live with wisdom and liberation in every step. The Buddha also said, just as the dawn is the forerunner of the rising sun, so right view, the forerunner of wholesome states. In Buddhist thought, right view has two directions, and I've been really investigating these two, because when I first heard them, I was like, what? I don't know what mundane and super mundane is. But mundane right view, which is Lokiya Samaditi, or worldly, a spiritual, a non-spiritual view. And most importantly, but it's the understanding of karma, and that our actions have consequences, and that good actions bring peace, and that harm brings suffering. Mundane view is not a theology, but a lived understanding that how we act matters. And that healing is possible even in hardship. Again, it is understanding karma and moral causality that wholesome actions lead to beneficial outcomes and unwholesome ones to suffering. So an example of mundane view is someone sees gossip. He sees how gossip or selfishness leads to fractured relationships and mistrust. And seeing it is being in a mundane view. And in my case, it was as a mother, recognizing how my actions caused my children to suffer and replacing those with kindness and attention. Super mundane by view. Lokottara Samadhi transcends beyond the physical world. It's spiritual. It's the clear and deep understanding of impermanence, non-self, and the Four Noble Truths. So this is super mundane right view. It sees that we're not our suffering, that we're not fixed selves, and that freedom is possible. An insight into the Four Noble Truths, a deeper wisdom that sees the impermanence and non-self nature of all phenomena. For example, a practitioner may reflect on craving, not as a personal failure, but as a conditioned suffering that can be ended. Myself, as a Black Puerto Rican, after years of internalized racial shame, I realized during meditation, this shame isn't mine. It was planted in me. So then I awakened the truth of suffering's conditioned nature and my capacity for liberation and freedom. Another example is a teacher who would choose culturally sustaining pedagogy rooted in compassion, or a community organizer who, while organizing, really reflects on craving as consumerism that is harming their community. There are many ways that we can see right view or ethical clarity in everyday life. And for us, the practitioner, that includes the following. It informs choices. It informs what to consume, how to speak, and how to engage at work. It gives us emotional clarity. We can ask ourselves, is this anger from injustice, or is this anger ego-driven? Or is this suffering I have to identify with? Or where does this suffering come from, if not from me? Review in everyday life can include social awakening. Social awakening we desperately need in these times. You know, recognizing the systems of suffering, oppression, and death, racism, patriarchy, capitalism, and right view can take the form of resisting through generosity and kindness and justice. It gives us spiritual honesty, knowing that suffering isn't failure and that we practice on our own path of liberation. And that, that suffering isn't a failure and that as we practice on our own path, that our liberation is really collective. It shows us all other factors, right intention, right speech, right action, etc., emerge from right view, which is why it's the first that we study on the Eightfold Path. Right view challenges internalized systems of dominance and builds clarity and courage in ethical action. And it's not just individual salvation, but collective liberation. It's Buddhist wisdom rooted in compassion, justice, and spiritual courage. Engaged Buddhism calls us to confront systems of oppression while holding the insight that all things are interdependent. So in closing, here are some follow-up questions for reflection. When have I acted from distorted view about myself or others or the world? How has wisdom already shown up in my life when I was honest, kind, and encouraged and courageous? What systems shape how I see the world? Excuse me. And which views no longer serve my liberation? I leave you with those questions and pass it to Jerry. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anya. Nice to get that perspective, mundane, super mundane, just that, and both being important. Yeah. Yeah, this has been a good month. Wise view, right view. Sometimes I make a distinction about that, sometimes not. Sometimes right seems like too dogmatic and wise seems to make more sense. But I like using right view in terms of this is going to get me there. And I'm going to use, a metaphor or analogy around this, and it's around hiking. I like going hiking. So, and getting out into the woods and so forth. So if I'm on a hike, my right view is down that path, which ultimately gets me to the trail end, gets me to my destination. So in that regard, it's important to have in mind, what's the destination? Where are we going? As Yogi Berra said, that great philosopher of our time, or maybe of my time, maybe not some of your time, is if you don't know where you're going, you're going to end up somewhere else. So it's helpful to know where you're going. And I think we're lucky to be born in these times. The type of communication, the way we can share ideas and information, like on Zoom and telecommunications and what have you. So Buddha, well, all of us, we're born, we check things out, we scope out the territory, and we have some sort of notion about a perspective about how to proceed. Buddha did this. He did it way back 2,600 years ago. And he tried a couple of trails. He went down a couple of trails in through these woods. The first one was living in kind of a lap of luxury with his family and pretty everything good and living in the palace. Things are provided. He was protected from difficulties. And as he looked at it, it kind of ran its course as he realized he bumped into things like, oh, people die. People get sick. We're getting older. Oh, that's going to be happening to me. He said, well, wait a minute. He was looking for a little bit more substance to his path than just indulgence. So he ended up following a spiritual path. And one path he followed is, okay, I'm going to deny all that interest in luxury and indulgence, and I'm going to go self-mortification, deny myself. And he basically was starving himself to death. And he came out and said, wait a minute. I'm not sure he said this. This isn't in the suttas. This is my summary. He said, wait a minute. This isn't working either. This is also a dead end. And then he comes up with the middle path. This is his view, the middle path. And so if I'm standing on a trailhead next to Buddha, he's going to say, yeah, you don't want to go over there, that indulgent path of, greed, hatred, and delusion, however you might want to call it. And you don't want to go down the other end where it's all self-denial. The path that I would recommend is the path of the Dhamma. It's that direction. So he'll point. He'll at the trail. He'll point. Okay, see up there. The mountain's there. There's a pass. See the pass on the mountain? You're going to head up there. The sun's just rising. Just keep on that trail, middle path. So I like that. So it has to do with a path which is recommended by somebody who we trust. But, you know, you don't just trust them mindlessly. You check it out for yourself. Oh, yeah, Buddha went this direction, but, oh, man, I'm not going to go over all those rocks and crevices. I'm going to find a little bit, you know, my own way through this. And along the way, I'm going to check with other people that have been on this trail. So, you know, I go to teachers. You know, yeah, there's a whole, in my path, and I, you know, I got exposed to Buddhism, you know, about 40, 50 years ago. And along the way, there are other people who kind of pointed the way. You know, Ruth Dennison was one. She taught me how to be mindful. She taught me how to pay attention. And if you're on a path, it's very important to pay attention. Where am I? Where am I going? Is this where I want to go? Is it aligned with where I want to go? Is it aligned with my highest aspirations? And that's an important one. What's it aligned with? What is keeping you on that trail? What is this path? And here's another teacher that, you know, I guess I got introduced in this regard. So Ajahn Suchito, one thing he's often said on the path, you know, you're checking as you're making decisions. You're making decisions based on for my welfare, for the welfare of others, leading to peace. So that it's your decision-making process is framed, my welfare, welfare of others, leading to peace. That makes sense to me. That resonates with me. It's better than, beating everybody and getting the most, you know, having the most money at the end of the game. For my welfare, that's important. Welfare of others leading to peace. Well, you bump into situations, points of decision. So, all right, here I am on a trail. What do I do under these circumstances? This is where the mindfulness comes in handy. Oh, my inclination is argue with this person and win this. Wait a minute. Is that leading to peace? All right, so you find a way to step forward, you know, with that framing in mind. And then, after you step forward, after you make that decision, you can also reflect back and consider, oh, did that work? Did that decision actually lead to peace? And maybe when you look back, maybe you just had an argument with somebody and you won the argument. Now you look back. Well, actually, you know, that might not have been the best deal. And you think, okay, next time I'm not going to hold those views and opinions quite as strongly. Okay, and so that comes into your wisdom. And that gets to be part of your view. And you move on forward. And it's slowly. And you run into obstacles. I went down to, about a week ago or so, I went down to Cape Disappointment. Beautiful area. I don't know if you've ever been there. But for the most part, I wasn't disappointed. But one day, I took this trail across this little peninsula. It was about a mile trail, and the trail got flooded, and I got stuck out there. I'm wading in, you know, knee-deep water, slogging on through. Yeah, So, okay. All right, it's like this now. Another supporting teaching. I mean, imagine some of you have heard that. I heard from Ajahn Sucitto and other teachers as well. Oh, it's like this now. Yes, it's not always pleasant. It's unpleasant. You know, I was saying, there's some suffering. There's dukkha along the way. And that allows you to be clearer and move on forward. And then things change. Things change. Things are impermanent. And then, oh, the trail leads on. So let me see if I want to add something. Rodney Smith was another good guide along the way. And he would say, relax, observe, and allow. There's a certain staying awake, checking things out, still on the right path, allow the difficulties, be with, and continue on. Sharon Salzberg and a number of others, what they add to our, you might say, our 10 essentials. Yeah, I guess our compass is for my welfare, welfare of others, leading to peace. But there's other parts of the 10 essentials. Sharon Salzberg talking about metta, compassion, brahmaviharas, sympathetic joy, appreciating others, gratitude, forgiveness, all part of our 10 essentials. You might have more essentials than that, but certainly, put those into your backpack and feel free to tap into them. And enjoy the trip, man. We're on it. We're on a wonderful trip. You start comparing our trip to some others. Oh my God. I'm grateful. I'm grateful for this path. And we're sharing this together. Yeah, that's one of the nice things. There's a sharing. There's a generosity. There's a mutual support. It's not just about me. It's we're all moving together, and I appreciate that. And that's what I have to offer this morning for Right View, for Wise View. Enjoy your day, and Suze, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Oh, boy. Lots of good stuff coming out from Nina and Jerry, and I really appreciate what both of them have said. Another teacher that has been important to me is Philip Moffat, who reminds us that we practice. That's what we're doing. And I love the image of being on a hike on the trail. So we're practice on our own path. And it's so important in each of these months and each of the teachings that we really figure out how to embody these teachings. And both Nina and Jerry have offered some really great ideas, Nina's questions and Jerry's different points along the trail. So I'm going to follow up with more practice suggestions. And it's fun doing these panels, but we don't really talk to each other about what we're going to share. So it's a little bit, okay, let's try this one. And so I'm going to try not to repeat what Nina and Jerry said, but maybe some of them are worth repeating. I think the first thing about really practicing with right view is owning that for each of us, it's our own inward personal path. We're doing the work. And some of those conversations you have in your head and you go, really, that's what's coming up. And then you want to judge it and stuff. It's only you and you. You're just there. And so you can say and investigate however you want. Nobody else is looking in, We're all here on our own. And I think the first important thing is to really acknowledge what are those views that we carry around and that guide our behavior, that guide our thinking, that guide our lives. It's not a one time and done kind of thing. I like how right view is at the beginning, but it really is at the end as well, because after all of the months of the Eightfold Path, it strengthens the view and we even get more wisdom. So we go back to last year with the Paramis, and we bring along that incredible commitment to honesty as we first of all examine what are the views that we carry along. And are they wholesome? Are they skillful? Do they, as both Nina and Jerry have raised the question, where do they lead? Do they lead to suffering or the end of suffering? Do they lead to my welfare, the welfare of others, and lead to peace? I want to just mention I love how the teachings are just filled with paradoxes. And there's such an invitation to work with them, because paradoxes are so sticky and kind of confusing. And Jerry mentioned, he didn't use the Pali word of ahi pasiko, but that's what he was talking about. Follow, you know, see for yourself, where is this path leading? And the Buddha in the sutta to the Kalamas, who were asking, hey, there are all these teachers that come in, and then this one says this way, and that one says that way, and what are we supposed to do? And the Buddha said, use your own sense of right and wrong and common sense. But at the same time, all of us, no matter how many years we've been practicing, we've been taught by one or more teachers, don't believe everything that comes into your mind. So there's that paradox. Follow your own sense of right and wrong and common sense, but approach it with a little bit of, really? Is this what we're supposed to be doing? And a guiding principle for that paradox is, what do these views yield? Where do they take us? And just because we don't want to just follow our own preferences simply because they feel good and they resonate with some of our own logic. Any view or belief has to be tested by the results it yields when put into practice and checked against the experience, not only our own experience, the people who are wise. There have been a number of teachers that have been mentioned, and I believe that this Sangha and all the other Sanghas we're part of are the wise people, our Kalyanamitas, we check it out with each other. So another practice is don't know mind. You know, they're so in right view. I don't know about you all, but boy, I believe my view is the right view. And so balancing that next to don't know mind is really helpful. It's a way of kind of investigating that, those views. Don't know mind is not a denial of what you know, but it's more an openness to discovering what is the actual truth of the moment. It's a practice of both humility and open-mindedness, and to see whether my own views are more about the way I want things to be as opposed to whether what is really happening. And then there are these views. Most of us, we're all conditioned beings. We've arrived here because of all of what has happened in our lives, all the views that we got from our parents, our community, our culture. And we look at our views and say, oh yeah, I understand why those views came up, why I keep carrying them around. But then I ask myself, are they still useful? One of the things I've shared many times in this Sangha, that issues around death and dying are really a big part of my practice. I was recently on retreat and some real old crap came up, and I thought, really? I thought I had dealt with all this stuff. And it was based in old views that I developed when I was a little kid as a way of protecting myself. And it manifests in some unskillful attitudes. And one of the things that came up as I was practicing with it is when I'm on my deathbed, I do not want to be telling myself this story. So it's a way of looking at some of those really sticky views. Do you want that view to be what is guiding you in those last moments or weeks or months before you die? Nina mentioned karma, and Ajahn Suchito says that right view is the recognition that what we do counts and that our own integrity has to be at the center of our lives. So the first tool in your toolkit for right view is understanding that everything we do matters. I love the words of the fifth recollection. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma, whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So we see the connections between our views and our actions, and we really ask ourselves, just like Jerry was saying, is this for my welfare, the welfare of others, and leading to peace? As I mentioned before, checking things out with other wise ones, really develop these Dhamma friendships. I don't know about you, but I love Dharma conversations with friends. When you bring up something that you're all entangled with, and your friends are not sad for you that you're entangled. They're excited and want to be part of that untangling. So remember the power of the Sangha. And then last, celebrate the results of this practice. The very first Sunday of this month, Nana talked about the results of when you know that you're really practicing with right view. And I just want to repeat a couple of them, because when those happen, it's like the third noble truth says liberation's possible, the end of suffering's possible. And we've actually all had those moments when there's less emotional reactivity, something happens, you get totally triggered, and then you pause and some of those Dharma stuff comes up. Maybe a teacher's voice comes in your head. Maybe your own practice, just like, oh, take some time. Quiet is always possible. What's the appropriate response? Every time you have that kind of response, celebrate it. You have an increased confidence because you've practiced with that paradox of ahipassako, and yet the mind still chatters all this nonsense, and you find your pathway. You're on that hike between nonsense and truth, and you're finding your way. And every time you experience that kind of decreased clinging to outcomes, less emotional reactivity, finding some, oh, that's what's really happening, not what I'm telling myself. I just say a big yay and know that you're on the right path and you're practicing your practice. So we all took a little longer, but I'm hoping that it was all of value to people. And then it goes back to Nina and she'll guide us in our conversation. Thanks for your attention, and thank you all for being part of my Sangha. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Suze and Jerry, for your wise words. And now we're just opening it up to any reflections that you have or any comments,
discussions. And something I meant to say, let me just say this at the beginning. I just talked to Ken Yasuhara, who's this magician who posts all of our talks on the website. That's how you can go. And their regular protocol for Monday nights is that the whole thing is recorded. So if anyone feels like they would prefer not having their comments recorded, just say so. And Nina can stop the recording for a little, for that 60 seconds or minute and a half or whatever. We just thought about that recently. So I just wanted to mention that everything is recorded. So back to you, Nina.
Yes. Well, please join us and you can go where you can put your hands up. Jean. Hi, Jean.
Good morning. I can hardly stay quiet when we talk about the Sangha, so that's where my little message comes from. The Sangha is beautiful. The wisdom arises from every rectangle on the screen, and it happens every time I sit down next to a practitioner in the meditation hall. So I'm really grateful for that description, and I just was bouncing in my chair to get a chance to say I'm grateful for being here, and to me this is a sacred space, and our community statement is just really powerful to me. So welcome one and all, and I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. We're glad you're here too. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Well, we'll be winding up. This is the wind up of Wise View.
Nina, I wanted to add a little something. In the Metta Sutta, there's a line or a couple lines that say that, you know, to do nothing that the wise ones would later reprove. And I'm surprised how powerful that one is for me. And I thought about, you know, I wouldn't want to do anything that Carrie, Tim, and Tawari reproved. But I include all of you, too, the wise ones. I really feel like my Sangha is both has my back, but also is a mirror and saying, hey, girl, I don't know, this, you may not want to go down that road or maybe not take that turn. And so just another comment about the power of Kalyanamitas and Sangha.
Yes. Yes. Very rich. Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else?
This is Mike. Let me get my camera going here. You know, when I think of right view, it's a matter of thought, because when we have a view, we're thinking. And I want to step back a little bit and give a metaphor of like, a screen, like a movie screen, is consciousness itself. And the content on the screen is thought. And so if we step back from thought or from view and look at consciousness, we might wonder, is my consciousness cloudy or is it really clear? Because I can't imagine having right view without having a really clear, completely full of light awareness or consciousness. So that would be my contribution. The other thing I noticed is that there was a student of the Buddha who was a very simple man, and he listened to the Buddha's discourses. And after he had finished, he went up and said, kind sir, I am a simple man. I've listened to your teaching for a long time, and there's a lot that I don't understand. Can you boil it down and make it really simple? And he said, yes. Be attached to nothing at all. And I listen to those words and I say, I've got a long way to go.
Thank you, Mike.
I really appreciate this group. I look forward to attending as many Sundays as I can. So thank you all for being here. And I feel the Sangha.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, your words remind me of some quotes that I heard this week, and the first one was, right view is seeing through eyes that are not clouded by longing.
Oh, yes. Good. Very good. And also, I want to share with you a prayer that His Holiness the Dalai Lama says every day. And I love this. It says, with a wish to free all beings, I shall go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha until I am enlightened. Inspired by the wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind for full awakening. As long as space endures, so long as sentient beings remain, therefore I shall too remain and dispel the miseries of this world. I remember once I was sitting on the edge of my bed and I say that and I just broke out crying, realizing how true that was, how deeply that sentiment had penetrated my heart.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Cheryl, you had your hand up.
Well, I was just going to tack on to something that Jean said about Sangha and a question that you asked, which was, I think, the very first question, which is something, when was the last time you were delusional? I think you worded it a little bit. But, you know, it was the help of Sangha, and it was something that had been going on for quite a while, and I just wasn't seeing it. And it was also early trauma, and, you know, and it was kind of like it all came together, and seeing it seeing it as everybody is my mirror. Everybody is my mirror. I am worthy, all that stuff. And that's the view. And it comes back to love versus hate. And so I think that's where my practice is. That's the direction my practice is going in a big way. It's kind of like, okay. Yeah. Just like Sue said, I don't want to be on my deathbed with this stuff. You know, it's like, and you know, when you're talking about karma makes it real. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. So thank you all for your talks. I really, really appreciate this Sangha a lot. Yeah.
Thank you. Hey, Jessica.
Hello. Actually, I just have a question as you were just talking. Is karma the same as karma? Is that the same word?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So, Jerry, I appreciate the trail metaphor because that was very helpful to me as far as I heard the Buddha story before about like the life of luxury and then the self-harming. I use a different word. I find that helpful. Also, the question, is this, you know, towards my well-being, the well-being of others, and towards peace? Because I find that I can go towards like the self-harming, even in a way of trying to be helpful towards society and do well, but then I can harm myself. And so I appreciate that it's a full question of, is it beneficial to me, the well-being of others, and to peace? Because even being able to see systems of oppression in the world, sometimes I can get caught up in trying to be helpful or trying to make change, but my ego is really, really involved in it. And so I feel like that practice of asking, like, is this actually beneficial to me as well as others and to peace is really helpful. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I like that inclusiveness. And it's also can be held up. It's not just about me. So it's inclusive of others, and I'm part of the whole. So yeah, I like that. And just in terms of language, karma, there is dharma and dhamma, karma and kama. Those are two different languages. One is Pali. The ones with R in are Pali. The other is Sanskrit, kama and dhamma.
Oh, cool. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for your offerings.
I think maybe we could take one more. Anybody wants to join in?
I just want to throw in the image that I had of my path this morning. I think it was, I saw my path as this, and it's something else you said in your talk, you know, which I really appreciated, is it's everything. And my path started a long, long time ago. It started the day I was born. And it's strewn with all this stuff. And I'm just kind of like walking through, throwing this, throwing that. And it's just this big, I don't know, it's this image that I had. And it was just like so real at the moment that this path is not, anyway, I don't even know what I'm trying to say. It was really messy. And it's all about dukkha. I can't be ashamed of the dukkha. The dukkha is there. That's the truth of the path. Anyway, it's all great imagery. You know, we do what we can.
Exactly.
I love that you described your path as a mess, because all of our paths are a mess. You know, and we're all entangled. And part of the path is figuring out what's the tangle and how do we find that end piece to get starting to untangle. And the teachings get us there, or sometimes just being unhappy and then you listen to somebody and they go, oh, wow, I like what they're saying. You know, whatever is that first little bit of the end of the string that's all tangled up. And then you start untangling, and that's what we're doing, and doing it together. I like the image of a mess. Actually, it's kind of comforting.
Yeah, right.
it's not personal. I mean, is there anyone on this screen on this morning? All these boxes where you're not a mess. I don't know. Raise your hand and show up. I mean, you're not a mess all the time. You know, yeah. But there is, anyway, I don't want to beat it.
Well, thank you, everyone. I love the sharing here.